The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
All right, we were talking about some of the consequences of logical atomism. I outlined the general structure of this philosophical position, particularly on the question of the relationship between language and reality. You can see again on the chart, logical atomism conceives of language as contained capable of being reduced to a perfect language. And the perfect language will be structured pretty much as it appears on the board. Each sentence in the perfect language will correspond to a fact in the universe, and each word in the perfect language will correspond to an element of a fact in the universe. Of course, in order to develop the perfect language, you have to reduce that language to its most elementary assertions. And you do that by means of Bertrand Russell's logic. Well, what are the results of this? In terms of epistemology, the knowable is what can be stated in the perfect language. What is knowable is what can be reduced to elementary propositions and stated in terms of the elementary in terms of that perfect language. Therefore, anything that cannot be broken down in that sort of way cannot be said, and what cannot be said cannot be known. And of course, what cannot be known and what can be cannot be said cannot be. So you have a parallel between being, knowing, and speaking that runs through logical atomism and through other forms of language analysis. All right, then we talked about ethics, but what do you do with propositions such as one ought to tell the truth, or you ought not to steal, or we have a responsibility to preach the word? What do you do with propositions about oughts, about responsibilities, about obligations? The answer in terms of Wittgenstein's Tractatus, is that these statements are not within the realm of the sayable. They cannot be expressed in the perfect language. They cannot be reduced to elementary propositions which refer to elementary facts in the world. These statements of ethics then are unsayable, and because they are unsayable, the subject matter of ethics is unknowable, and therefore the reality of values is something that cannot be said to exist. It cannot properly be said to be. Now, Wittgenstein is very uncomfortable with that way of looking at ethics because he himself, in terms of his life, is a very ethically sensitive individual. He's a man who feels great shame and is in his life. He's a man who feels a great sense of guilt over the way he's treated other people. He's a man who feels great resentments over the way others have treated him. He's a man who's constantly accusing himself of pettiness and trying to atone for his sins in various ways. At times he even turns to religion. At times he leaves the discipline of philosophy. There was a period when he was away from philosophy and working in a monastery for a while. There were times in his life when he had thoughts of becoming a monk. But apart from all of this, you see, when he sits down to think philosophically, when he sits down to try to work out a rational understanding of the world, he cannot find in that system any place for ethics. Nevertheless, he does feel that there's some sense that we have a kind of sense that these obligations, you know, really are nailed down to something in reality, that they have something to do with the world. And so he talks about Das Mystische. He talks about the mystical realm. It is very similar to Kant's noumenal realm. You can, I think, pretty well understand what he's getting at if you when you hear that phrase Das Mystische, if you think of the Kantian noumenal. Ethics then belongs to that, but belonging to that, it cannot be expressed, it cannot be known, and it cannot be properly claimed as an aspect of the universe. It's in a completely different classification from anything that you can speak of in the universe. All right, what about religion? Well, Wittgenstein has quite a bit to say about religion. There's only one work of his that deals at any length with religion. That's the Lectures and Conversations, which belong to another phase of Wittgenstein's thought. But in the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, there are quite a number of isolated statements about God, about religion, and so on. One of the famous statements is that God does not reveal himself in the world. Now, Wittgenstein has been taken by some people, such as John Warwick Montgomery, for instance, to have reached a kind of Christian view of transcendence. That is to say, according to Montgomery's interpretation, and I don't think I'm overstating this, Wittgenstein studies the universe, he studies the facts, and he discovers that within the world there are no absolutes. Within the creation there is no absolute. He feels a need for an absolute, and so he comes to the idea of a God who exists beyond the world, a transcendent factor of some kind that needs to be invoked in order to account for the world. Now, I maintain that's a very wrong way of looking at Wittgenstein's early writings. It seems to me that, again, you have to interpret this in the Kantian mold. And I don't know why this structure comes out looking so much like Kant. Wittgenstein himself didn't read Kant very much, but he did read Kierkegaard, and that may have something to do with it. But anyway, Wittgenstein really wants to say something like this, that the world as it is, in the world as it is, as our sense data presents it to us, you cannot discover anything absolute. You cannot discover any values. You can only discover facts. The perfect language can only report facts, and only elementary facts at that. The concept of God cannot be reduced to such reports of elementary facts. And since the concept of God cannot be reduced to such reports of elementary facts, there is something illegitimate about the very concept of God. The concept of God may not play a role in our metaphysics. God cannot be said to be knowable. God cannot be said to be an element of the world. It cannot. God cannot be said to be a part of the metaphysical scheme that we develop. Now that, you see, and then Wittgenstein tends to express that in fairly religious language. He says, look, what that means is what religions have always taught, namely that God is somehow beyond the world. Well, it's a kind of negative transcendence, you see. It's a transcendence where that you arrive at by what Thomas Aquinas would have called the via negativa. You simply don't find God in the world. You don't find any evidence of him here. You find no basis for talking about him in your investigation of creation. So you say, if he exists anywhere, if there is anything that might be called a God, he does not exist in this world. That's really about as far as you can go on Wittgenstein's basis. You can't say that God really exists in another world. And certainly, of course, to look out at this creation and to say there's no evidence of God, to look out at this creation and to say that God does not manifest himself in the world is certainly very far from a biblical position. So You see, I think that the kind of apologetic use of Wittgenstein that's made by Montgomery and some of these other people is quite illegitimate. To Wittgenstein, God, if he exists in some kind of Kantian noumenal, where he cannot have any influence upon our decisions, where he can't determine in any way the structure of our thinking or the structure of being as we understand it. Now, this system has some further implications, however, that are somewhat damaging to the system of logical atomism. For one thing, I might just mention in passing that the human self is in the same category as God and ethical value. If you look out in the world, you don't see yourself, okay? You don't see the self that's looking. Now, of course, you can look in the mirror and see your reflection, but your reflection is not you. You can hold out your hand and you can see an image of your hand, but the hand is not the knowing subject. The hand is not the thing that's looking at the hand. So you don't really see the self as you look out in the world. Now, this is just a recapitulation of Hume's argument, you see, that when you consider your experience, and you consider your experience alone, you don't find the self as one of the items of experience. And so Hume, you remember, disposed of the self. Hume argued that the self was simply a bundle of perceptions. Well, Wittgenstein also feels the force of this kind of argument, and he argues that the self, too, is something which does not exist within the world. The self, too, is something that cannot be discovered in our experience. The self belongs also to the realm of the unsayable. The concept of the self cannot be reduced to reports of elementary experiences. And so, therefore, the concept of the self, too, must be relegated to Das Mystische. It has to be relegated to the world beyond. The world that we can talk about, the world that we know exists. Similarly, you cannot talk about the world as a totality. You cannot talk about the world as a unified whole, because that wholeness of the world, that unity of the world, is not a datum of experience. It's not something that can be broken down into elementary facts. It's not something that can be expressed in the perfect language. So the world as a whole, the concept of the world as an ordered totality, that also belongs to Das Mystische. Now that, again, is another Kantian assertion. Kant also held that God, moral value, the self, and the world, the unity of the world, is that these are all noumenal objects. Furthermore, Wittgenstein argued that in the perfect language, you cannot really describe the relationship between language and reality, all right? This is a difficult point to catch, and I wish I could spend a lot more time on it. You'll just have to take my word for it that there's a problem here. Wittgenstein himself felt that there was a problem here, and he wrestled with it, and he admitted that he couldn't find any answer to it. That is to say, when you look out at the world, you speak about the world. That language cannot include anything about the relationships between language and reality. Language can do only one thing in Wittgenstein's system. It can picture facts, all right? Language can only picture facts. It cannot picture relationships between facts and something else. It cannot picture relationships between facts and some other order of reality. Now, sure, from a naive point of view, you can look out in the world and you can see people using language, and you can read language that's been written down, and you can show the relationship between the word chair and the chair. You know, you can do that. That's all within your experience. That's not what Wittgenstein is talking about. You can show the relationship between language and reality in that sense. But you see, there's a somewhat deeper metaphysical level at which this relationship between language and reality comes up. as you look out in your experience and you see the language and you see the reality, really you're just seeing two different kinds of facts. You see, this is all within the realm of facts. This is all within the realm of things that can be reduced to elementary sensations and so on and so forth. But then when you try to take this whole spectrum of facts and relate this whole spectrum of facts to something else, namely a language which refers to it, then you see you find yourself in trying to do something else than picture facts. You find you're trying to show relationships between facts and some other order of reality, and that cannot be done. Wittgenstein felt that that attempt to show in general the relationship between language and reality, that attempt is something that cannot be done within language. It's something that cannot be done within the perfect language, and therefore it shouldn't be done within any language at all. Now, what this boils down to then is that Wittgenstein comes to the end of the book, comes to the end of the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, and he's forced to conclude that most of the things he's been saying throughout the book amount to nonsense. All right? Most of the things he's been saying throughout the book amount to nonsense. Why? Because Wittgenstein admits that he's been saying all sorts of things that cannot be said. Wittgenstein admits that he's been saying all kinds of things that cannot be expressed in the perfect language, that cannot be reduced to elementary propositions, that cannot be properly said in terms of his own system. After all, he's been talking about God. He's been saying that God is beyond the world. He's been talking about values, not only in the explicitly ethical sections of the book, but also in places where he tries to tell us what language ought to mean, or how language ought to be used, or what ought to be said and what should not be said. Throughout the book, there are expressions of value. There are value judgments being made. And supposedly, if you take his theory very strictly, such value judgments are impossible. Such value judgments should not be made. Furthermore, Wittgenstein has tried in the book to show the relationship between language and reality. And this is something which he holds that, strictly speaking, cannot be done. And so he comes to the end of the book, and he utters the following statements, which are most remarkable. If you look this up in the Tractatus, this is statement number 6.54. It's a very complicated numbering system that he has, and also statement 7, I'll quote to you. He says in 6.54, he says, "My propositions are elucidatory in this way. He who understands me finally recognizes them as senseless when he has climbed out through them, on them, and over them. He must, so to speak, throw away the ladder after he has climbed up on it. He must surmount these propositions, then he sees the world rightly." And then statement seven, "Whereof one cannot speak, thereof must one be silent." And then he closes the book. Now, you see what's happening. He's developed a very rational theory about how language refers to the world and what we can say about the traditional philosophical problems in the light of that philosophy of language. He's developed a very carefully thought out scheme. He comes to the end of it and he says that in terms of the scheme itself is senseless. The scheme itself cannot be referred to in language. However, he says that by this very experience, by this experience of seeing the breakdown of the scheme, you've come to get a better perspective, huh? Now compare this with what Knudsen said about existentialism, okay? Compare this with the idea of trying to reach being and failing, and trying to overshoot the the realm of meaning and shooting up there and trying to get to the positive line and the failing to do that, but learning something from the experience and trying to develop a theory which includes both positive and negative. Well, there's something of that here. You attempt to develop a very rational theory of how language operates and how the world is put together. You discover that in terms of that theory, the whole enterprise is senseless, but having learned that, you know something that you didn't know before. Having learned that, you learn not to ask certain questions. You learn that the philosophical questions that troubled you really are meaningless questions, really don't have any answers to them, and therefore should not have been asked in the first place. And so you reach a stage where the questions themselves dissolve, and you remain silent because you know that these things cannot be talked about. So Wittgenstein says, whereof one cannot speak, thereof must one be silent. Now this is has a good history going back in the literature of mysticism. This is what the mystics have always said, that you start off trying to analyze the world very rationally. You have to, the medieval mystics said that you have to pay quite a bit of attention to the Christian dogmas, to the doctrines of Scripture at the beginning of your quest. But as you grow, as you develop, as you become purified, as you become illumined, you finally reach a stage where you really don't need all of these propositional crutches anymore. You no longer need all of these rational schemes. Once you achieve union with the ultimate, you can throw all those things away, as it were, although they're still needed for people who haven't reached the level that you've reached. Now, that kind of thing is very common in the history of mysticism, and here Wittgenstein is following that to a certain extent. And it also has its rationalistic side. Wittgenstein thinks that this is the only conclusion that reason itself can reach. So you do have a combination of rationalism and irrationalism, rationalistic attempt to understand the world, which frustrates itself, which falls back on itself, and then an appeal to mysticism to surmount the whole situation. Now, Wittgenstein took himself very seriously. After writing this sentence, whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent, Wittgenstein was silent for a while. He left the discipline of philosophy. He went away from Cambridge and disappeared. For a while, nobody could find him at all. He spent some time designing a house for his sister in Vienna. He spent some time working as a gardener in a monastery. He did quite a number of things, but he avoided all talk of philosophy. And all of these famous philosophers became very interested in the Tractatus, and they tried to chase him down to discuss the whole thing with him, and he wouldn't have anything to do with them for about 10 years. He just completely avoided the whole discipline. Now, people have speculated as to why that was so. You know, I'm sure there were various psychological reasons and so on that can be adduced. But you see how the thrust of his philosophy itself is sufficient explanation. There may have been other explanations, but certainly just following the thrust of his philosophy alone would be enough to drive him to that kind of conclusion. Well, he says, we've said all that can be said. There's nothing more to say. We ought to keep silent then about these philosophical issues. Well, nevertheless, we can't stop there. That's not the end of language analysis. And while Wittgenstein was away from the scene, there were other people who got busy. When Wittgenstein was in hibernation, some of his friends in Vienna read the Tractatus, and they fell in love with it. And they combined it with some of the current ideas that were floating around on the concerning philosophy of science, and they came up with a kind of simplified version of logical atomism, which has traditionally been called logical positivism. Logical positivism is different from logical atomism in a number of ways. For one thing, logical positivism no longer assumes that language is or ought to be a perfect picture of reality. Logical positivism abandons the picture theory of meaning. It abandons the idea that all language has to be reduced to its simple components, and that once you get language reduced to its simple components, it will be a perfect picture of the world. You don't have that in logical positivism. In fact, the logical positivists felt that that was itself an attempt to get beyond what we can know. Logical positivists thought that was an illegitimate kind of metaphysics. They thought that here we were trying to deduce the general structure of reality from the structure of our language and logic, and they felt that that simply cannot be done. They took an anti-metaphysical attitude. They felt that metaphysics, to develop a theory about the general structure of reality, is completely beyond the competence of philosophers. It's simply something that cannot be done. The job of philosophy, according to these positivists, simply to analyze the language of science. If you want to know what exists, don't ask a philosopher. Ask a scientist. It's the scientist who determines what exists and what doesn't exist. It's the scientist who determines what the structure of the world is like. The philosopher has no special information on this subject. The philosopher has no way of attaining truth that's not open to the scientist. What should the philosopher do? Well, the job of the philosopher is simply to analyze and clarify the language of science. To analyze and clarify the language of science. Well, that seems to be a very modest proposal. It seems that philosophy now is being cut down to size and that it shouldn't try to attempt very much. But actually, logical positivism is one of the most arrogant philosophies that's ever been dreamed up by the mind of man. logical positivism, you see, rejects all metaphysics, all philosophical views of the world, all ethics, all religious language, as being meaningless in one sense of the term meaningless. Now, let me try to explain how this goes according to the positivists. The positivists divide language into, there are different categories and different writers, but let's take this group of four categories as fairly representative of positivist thinking. The categories of language then on the board, tautologies, contradictions, empirical assertions, and emotive language. Now, tautology is what Jerry Gill calls a definitional sentence, a definitional sentence. We've discussed that in some of our discussion groups. A tautology is a statement that's, at least according to the positivists, is true purely by virtue of the meanings of the terms, truly by virtue of the meanings of the terms. A good example of a tautology would be the statement, the chair is a chair. Well, you know that that's true purely by virtue of the meanings of the terms. You know that that's true because you know how the word chair is used. Or take the statement, either it will rain tomorrow or it will not. Either it will rain tomorrow or it will not. Now, you know that that's true. And why do you know it's true? You don't know it's true because you have a lot of weather forecasting apparatus. Even if you know nothing at all about forecasting the weather, you know that that statement is true. Why? Well, because you know how to speak English. You know how to use that particular language. Either it will rain tomorrow or it won't. Well, you know what rain is. You know what the coupling either or means. You know the difference between raining and not raining. And having known the meanings of the terms, you know that the statement is true. So this class of tautologies, these are statements that are true by definition, true by virtue of the meanings of the terms, true apart from any empirical verification. All right, that's important. True apart from any empirical verification. This is simply to say that you don't need weather forecasting equipment in order to decide if that sentence I uttered a few seconds ago is true. Either it will rain tomorrow or it won't. You don't need to have information about the cold fronts and the warm fronts in order to affirm that statement. Or if I say either it is raining outside or it is not, you don't have to go outside in order to determine whether that's true or false. You know that it's true just by virtue of the definitions of the term. So you don't need experience to verify that statement. You don't need empirical verification. All right, then there's a class of statements that are false by definition, the contradictions. This would be a statement like, it is raining and it is not raining. And you know that that's false simply by the meanings of the terms. And the third class would be classes of empirical statements. It is raining. Well, if you're going to find out whether that's true, you have to go out and look. Or you have to talk to somebody else who's gone out and looked. You can't verify that simply by reference to the meanings of the terms. So you see the difference between an empirical statement and a tautology. Then the fourth category is kind of a catch-all in logical positivism. Some of the positivists use the term emotive to cover this class, but that's not really a very good label. They included a lot of things under that that can't really be described as emotive, but a properly emotive statement would be kind of an exclamation, let's say. Oh, what a beautiful morning. Well, that's not something that a scientist can verify, but it expresses a feeling that you have. Or if you shout out, wow, or you say, my oh my, or something stronger, or whatever, you're expressing an emotion. Now, there were a lot of there's a lot of language that was thrown into this category by the positivists that we don't usually think of as emotive, and I'll talk about that in a minute. Now, all of these statements can be said to be meaningful in various ways. Of course, tautologies are meaningful. You know the meanings of the terms, and you know what's being said. Contradiction, well, you might want to say that that's meaningless because contradiction, is false by definition. We won't get into that debate. Some people have said they are meaningful in a sense. Empirical assertions, obviously, they're meaningful. They report facts, and you get information through empirical assertions. And emotive utterances, too, have a kind of meaning to them. When you say, wow, or when you say, oh, that's beautiful, or something, expressing something, and that language has a use. It conveys something to somebody else. But the positivists argued that emotive statements are not cognitively meaningful. That is to say, they don't report facts about the world. They don't give you information about the world. They might express an attitude that you have, but they can't tell you anything about the world that you don't know otherwise. Now, the question then that the positivists try to address themselves to is, how big is class three? What statements can be put into class three and what statements cannot be? Now, generally speaking, we argue that we think that ethical statements belong to class three. Ethical statements do seem to be expressing facts. They do seem to be telling us something about reality. It's wrong to steal. That seems to tell you a fact about the world that you hadn't known before. Religious assertions such as God exists, well, we make that assertion on the basis of some experiences that we've had. And that assertion simply certainly does seem to express a fact. And so we would be inclined, I think, at first glance anyway, to put both ethical and religious statements into class three. But the positivists argued that there are real problems in this. It's very difficult to put these things in class three. They argued this way, that no statement can be truly empirical unless it is capable of being verified in a manner similar to the methods of natural science, all right? A statement cannot be truly empirical. It cannot be a cognitively meaningful statement of fact unless it can be verified in a manner analogous to the methods of natural science. Now, I'm being purposively vague here. This is the so-called verification principle. And one of the major problems in positivism was the problem of defining the verification principle. What sort of verification do we require of a sentence if it is to be put in class three? Now, the positivists differed very much among themselves as to what sort of verification is required. Early in the positivism, it was said that you have to be able to conceive how a sentence could be conclusively verified, if you are to accept it as meaningful. Now, of course, take a statement there is iron on the moon, made before let's say there is iron on Saturn. Now, nobody knows for sure because nobody's been there, but you can imagine how that might be conclusively verified. Somebody could take a spaceship there or send an unmanned vehicle and send it down on Saturn and poke around, and if they find some iron there, well, that conclusively verifies the statement that there is iron on Saturn. So you can imagine how that would be conclusively verified. Now, you haven't verified it, but you can imagine how it would be conclusively verified. And that was one formulation of the verification principle. If you can conceive of a method by which a statement can be conclusively verified, then you can say that it's cognitively meaningful. Then you can put it in class three. You can put it in the class of empirical statements. Unfortunately, that particular formulation of the verification principle completely broke down when somebody recognized that that this makes all the laws of science cognitively meaningless. Because you see, the laws of science are stated in universal terms. If anything, goes up, it must come down. The word all comes in frequently. Laws purport to be universal. They purport to cover all instances. Now, of course, scientists cannot investigate all instances. Scientists cannot conclusively verify that those laws are true, but they do think it's meaningful to talk about laws in that sort of general way. Therefore, if you adopt this form of the verification criterion that I mentioned, then all of these laws become cognitively meaningless, and it seems very odd to do that. The positivists, of course, many of them were practicing scientists, and so they didn't want to have their own laws invalidated in that kind of way. So they shifted to another form of the verification principle. In the writings of Karl Popper, particularly, you have the principle stated in this way, that you ought to be able to conceive of how a sentence can be conclusively falsified in order to say that it's meaningful, cognitively meaningful. Now, what does that mean? Well, if you have some sentence, there's iron on Saturn or something, well, you have to be able to conceive of a procedure to show that that sentence is false. Now, maybe it's not false, maybe it's true, but anyway, you determine its meaningfulness by showing how you might disprove it, showing how it could conceivably be disproved, by showing that there's a method, at least, for disproving it. Now, that formulation also fell through for a similar reason to the way the earlier one did, because you see, on this basis, all particular assertions of science become empirically meaningless. For instance, that very illustration that I used about iron on Saturn. How are you going to conclusively falsify that there's iron on Saturn? The prospects of doing that boggle the mind. You'd really have to investigate every single atom, every single molecule. There's no conceivable way of doing that. To say that unicorns don't exist, or to say that such and such exist, can you conclusively falsify a statement like that? No, you'd have to go through the whole universe and study everything in the universe in order to be able to conclusively falsify the statement that a particular thing exists, or that a particular thing doesn't exist. And so this form of the verification principle then was also rejected. So the positivists then tried a third form of the verification principle. This is the idea that a statement is cognitively meaningful if you can produce some evidence that's relevant to its confirmation or disconfirmation. All right? A statement is cognitively meaningful if you can produce evidence that's relevant to its confirmation or to its disconfirmation. Now, this seemed to allow for all of the scientific language. This seemed to say that scientists are free to make generalizations because clearly there is evidence relevant to those generalizations. Scientists are free now to talk about the existence or non-existence of particular things because there is evidence that's relevant to such discussions, even though conclusive verification or falsification is out of the question. But you see, once you relax the verification principle this far, then you start letting in all kinds of things that you don't want to have. You see, what the positivists really wanted was a kind of principle that would allow all the scientific language but would exclude all the language of metaphysics, ethics, and religion. And you can exclude all of those things from these strong forms of the verification principle, but you cannot exclude all of these things from this weaker form of the verification principle. Because when you weaken it this way, all the metaphysicians, all the religious people, all the ethical philosophers will come in and say, oh yes, we have evidence. We have evidence that's relevant. We can't prove, we can't disprove, we can't show you how to conclusively verify or conclusively falsify, but we can bring you some evidence that's relevant to confirming or disconfirming almost any theory, no matter how weird it is, has some kind of evidence that it brings forth in order to lend some credibility to its hypothesis. So if you weaken the verification principle this far, you see, you don't have any basis for excluding any kind of language at all. Now, this is really the type of argument that led to the destruction of the verification principle as a theory. And you see now how this bears upon Christianity. Of course, the positivists started off by saying, look, Christianity is statements about God, particularly statements about salvation, statements about Christ, statements about the love of God. All of these things are meaningless because you cannot think of any way of conclusively verifying them or conclusively falsifying them that accord with generally accepted scientific methods. Well, of course, if the standard of conclusive verification or conclusive falsification, if that standard is rejected, then that positivist critique of religion is also rejected. Then there's still a further problem that afflicted logical positivism, and this is perhaps an even more serious problem. That is the status of the verification principle itself. Now, forget about the difficulties involved in formulating the principle. Just think about the principle under any formulation and ask whether that principle is cognitively meaningful or not. Is that principle cognitively meaningful? The principle that you must verify a sentence in order to show that it's that a sentence must be verifiable in order to be cognitively meaningful. Is that principle verifiable? Is that principle falsifiable? Well, clearly, what class of statements does that come into? Well, it's not a tautology. It's not true by virtue of the meanings of the words. It's not a contradiction. There's nothing obviously contradictory about it. Is it empirical? Well, think about that. How did the positivists arrive at the verification principle? Did they study the whole realm of human knowledge to discover the relationship between verification and meaningfulness in this instance, in this instance, in this instance? Did they take samples of statements and samples of different kinds of verification and empirically compare the two to determine how meaningfulness correlates with verification? No, there were no empirical studies done on this at all. In fact, this principle does not arise out of any empirical study. It's a rule that's laid down before any empirical study is done. In fact, it's a rule that's laid down in order to govern empirical study. Now, therefore, it would seem that the verification principle itself becomes cognitively meaningless on this theory. It doesn't meet the standard of conclusive verification. It doesn't meet the standard of conclusive falsification. It's not even clear what evidence is relevant to confirm it or disconfirm it. It's set forth as a rule. It's set forth as what I might call a presupposition or a basic commitment. All right, so on this basis then, I ask the question number four under B, can the verification principle itself be verified? And most people have said no, and again, this is why very few people are willing to call themselves logical positivists today. But now, positivism has is still with us in a kind of modified sense. And you've all read some of this material, I think, the so-called flu problem. Anthony Flew, in his essay called Theology and Falsification, which is in your bibliography, he presents this parable of the garden, you know, where the two explorers are going through the jungle and they find a plot of ground that looks like it might be cultivated or it might not be. And one of the explorers is sure that there's a gardener. The other explorer is sure that there's no gardener. They make different tests. They try to confirm, they try to disconfirm, they try to verify, they try to falsify. None of them work. Nevertheless, the one explorer still is absolutely sure that there's a gardener there, and he ignores all the evidence to the contrary. Or rather, having seen and weighed all the evidence to the contrary, he still maintains his belief. And then finally, in exasperation, the one explorer says to the other, how does your belief in an untestable, invisible, elusive gardener differ from an imaginary gardener? Now, what's the difference between your concept of a gardener and a pure illusion? Or what's the difference between your gardener and no gardener at all? And this is the kind of problem that Flew brings to Christianity or to religions generally. He argues that religions, even though they're confronted with all this evidence against the truth of their faith, nevertheless they refuse to acknowledge it, and they still hang on to their concept of God at all costs, even though there's no way of distinguishing this concept there's no way of showing the difference between God existing and God not existing. And this is the kind of problem then that Jerry Gill and Ramsey and some of these people that you read about a couple of weeks ago, that some of these people are wrestling with.